we go from religion to science here. Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop on this Thursday, May 8th. I'm Ray Graff. It's time for another Science Forum. And our panel of experts are here. They're ready to answer your questions. If you have a scientific question, feel free to call 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Say, what makes the smoke white? Why is it black? We want to know the science behind this sort of thing. And our own College of Scientific Cardinals are here. The number is 800-348-2551, Science Forum. Or you can email the show at voxpop@wamc.org. Back after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's time once again to reconvene the Science Forum. Our experts are here. They are ready to respond to your questions. Whether they will answer them, I don't know, but they will respond in some fashion, perhaps derisively. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551 if you want to call in. These science forums are usually fun, so you make it fun. You call in with something good. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you wish. voxpop@wamc.org or 800-348-2551 if you want to call on the science forum. With all that being said, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Hey, everybody. It's Barbara Brabets from SUNY Cobleskill. I am a biochemist, so I teach biology and chemistry. Shocker.
Oh, exciting.
And I'm Roger Giaboni, and I'm from Rogers High Fidelity, and I'm an electrical engineer.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Who are you?
I'm Jim Pickett. Oh, yeah. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired.
All right.
Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill. I teach, geology, environmental science, astronomy, and anything Barbara doesn't teach.
Now, classes are done, right?
Oh, no. One more day.
One more day of classes.
One more day.
Can I just tell you that Cobleskill has maybe the best Burger King I've ever been to?
That, you know what? I think so. We've talked about that before.
Have we done it on
air?
Yeah,
but it's really a gem.
We're all the same, Burger King.
But there's quality in those onion rings.
Well, you know, out on another college visit and driving all through Central New York a couple weekends ago, so I went back to the same one in Kobe and got breakfast this time.
Mm.
Yeah, nice.
I don't know if I've had breakfast at Burger King
lately.
Oh,
burrito the size of your head.
Oh, my gosh.
It was fantastic.
Yeah.
The number here is 800-3, but enough about breakfast burritos. 800-348-2551, that's the number. All right, we talked about at the intro the smoke. We'll get to that. But right now, it looks like Jim Pickett has his tail between his legs, and he's got a correction, and he feels terrible.
I do.
What was the correction about?
Oh, this was terrible. We talked last time, I think, about a gravity anomaly in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
And we described it as being a center of higher gravity. In fact, it's lower gravity.
So it's a big cavern under there?
Well, yeah, there's apparently lower density down in the mantle.
Ah.
If you Google it, you get nice images of things that look like bathtub drains. That's not what it's like. It's a shallow depression, hundreds of kilometers in diameter and only about 100 meters deep.
You know,
so kind of like an ice cream scoop through the Stewart's ice cream.
But the important thing is that if you were to go there, you could jump higher than other places.
Just a little bit.
A little bit.
So, all right, geologist, you never get a chance to talk on this show.
That's true.
Tell us more about this.
Actually, though, if you were on the water, it'd be the same because the water would it brings you closer to the center of the Earth. So the
gravity will be the same. If you were at sea level here or sea level there, you'd still be able to jump a little bit higher over there.
Assuming you could walk on water.
Well, or jump on water for that matter.
Okay. Yes. Anything more you want to talk about this gravity anomaly?
Well, only that it's a Bouguer anomaly. That's very important.
Bouguer?
Ooh, that's what it's called?
Yes.
Nice.
Well, no, the guy who discovered it was Mr. Bouguer.
Oh, bougie. We call that bougie these days.
Oh, is he a bougie? Yeah, okay.
Can we start the show again?
Yes, let's start over.
All right, so what's the deal? How does the smoke get white, Barbara Brabets? I know you did some research.
So in the ancient times, which was like the 90s.
Right.
The other millennium. They used to generate black smoke by taking the ballots, which they're burning, right?
Right.
And they would mix it with a little bit of tar or pitch, something blackish, in order to put the black smoke out. Well, they've decided to upgrade their chemistry game, and I have to say, it's a good upgrade. So for black, what they use is they use potassium perchlorate, which is primo stuff. This is an oxidizer. It allows your burning to happen faster. So imagine if you took like Sunday's newspaper and put it in the fireplace, it doesn't just burn up all quickly. It kind of languishes as it burns because it's really dense and not great burning material.
No.
So they put this potassium perchlorate in to kind of make it all happen at once so that you get the effect. But with it, they throw in two things. They throw in anthracene, which is the stuff that makes it black. It's a derivative of tar. So it's kind of like instead of bringing the tar with the anthracene in it, they just put the anthracene in.
Okay.
It's a good name for coal tar is what it is.
Yeah, right. But it's actually a tricyclic benzene. I know that's
makes
way
all the
too
difference.
That's way too much for
you
the
don't
radio.
Want to cook your burgers on this
Please
stove.
Please don't. I mean, not on this stove. And then just in case you didn't like your burger burnt. They also add some sulfur, which increases the rate at which it burns. That's why we put sulfur on the tip of a match to make it burn fast.
Fascinating.
If you go to white, they switch out the oxidizers. So instead of perchlorate, they use potassium chlorate, which is just a little bit less oxidizing. And then their source of... Oh, they used to use wet straw. That was what they used to use.
How long ago?
The 90s.
They used wet straw in the 90s.
I'm sure it was all the rage to try to get some straw and have it ready to go for the conclave.
Interesting.
But now they use lactose, so you can buy lactose at a health food store now. And then to make the white part, they use resin. So really the stuff that's in pine trees. So when you burn a pine tree real fast, like your Christmas tree goes up in smoke, hopefully not in your living room.
You're not supposed to burn pine logs in your
chimney.
Exactly,
because it creates a lot of creosote.
So who's the chimney sweep over at the Vatican?
Well, they install this chimney just for the conclave. It's not like it's there all the time. Like, they have a hatch that then they go and they put up the little chimney just for this.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's a temporary stove. I saw it. I saw it on Google.
So what you're saying is, for the black smoke, they're making gunpowder.
Pretty much, yes.
And
then
what it is.
Burning it incompletely, you know.
Incomplete gunpowder burning.
133 ballots, right? And then they're basically burning pine with not wet straw, but
so
rather
interesting.
But
yeah,
what happens
lactose.
If they're lactose intolerant?
Then they better not breathe in the smoke.
You're using up all your A material too early in the show, Ed.
I don't have much left, so it's okay.
Fine.
It's finals week.
The number is 800-348-2551. It's a science forum of a kind. And if you have a science question, feel free. This email at voxpop@wamc.org. Nick writes in, assuming the pump is always the same, does any given house's water pressure change depending on how full the well is? Does the depth of the well affect pressure? And that's from Nick.
No.
Because your water pump pumps it into a tank that the pressure is controlled by the pressure in the air bladder in the tank.
Right. There's a bladder that they put compressed air above it, and that compressed air compresses or releases to keep a constant pressure on the water main.
Okay.
Otherwise, it'd be too much for that water pump to have to turn on, turn off, turn on,
now,
turn off,
there
turn
are,
on, turn
there
off.
Are certain well systems, they call them jet pumps, that don't have a holding tank, but they are known to have varying pressures because of their self-priming pumps, and they have varying pressures.
And that's why you have variable speed pumps when you're using those types of pumps.
All right, fascinating. And Nick also writes in, completely separately, can a baseball be hit just as far off a tee as if it was pitched? And I would say no.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would say no, because you're getting constant. If it's pitched fast, when the bat contacts it, you're putting in the kinetic energy from the bat, but you're also basically reflecting the momentum from the pitch.
They always used to say faster in, faster out.
Right. 110 now. 110, 120 coming off the bat. That's what we're seeing.
I'm not so sure I agree with that.
Really?
Right? When the baseball's coming in, it goes to zero. The velocity goes to zero. So the energy goes to zero.
Yeah.
And then it turns around and comes back.
But the wood's absorbing it, right?
Well, it's absorbing that energy. But in order for the... Well, some of it is.
Well, yeah, it's absorbing a small amount. But the whole point of the hardwood is that
it's reflecting it.
It's reflecting it, not absorbing it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when my son was in baseball, for a time, until they got older, they could use these composite bats or these metal bats. You know, it's dangerous. My kid was a big kid, and some of these kids were big, and they're hitting the ball really hard. Those bats had a lot of spring to them.
So when the baseball reverses, it goes to zero velocity, which means it goes to zero kinetic energy before it goes back.
But it's also
out
rotating.
The field.
But it's also rotating.
But but that energy is goes into the compression of the bat and the distortion of the ball.
So from kinetic to potential.
Think of it in terms of throwing a baseball against a brick wall. It bounces off and comes back. And the harder you throw it, the harder it's going to come back.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, the thing that we used to do in class is take a basketball and put a baseball on the top of it and then drop it. And what would happen is, as it hit the floor, the energy of hitting it would actually make the baseball go up about 20, 30 feet.
Okay, so that's basically the same thing
as a
baseball bat.
It's a reflection.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not, right? Because you're compressing the basketball, which is a spring action, and that's kx or kx squared. I don't remember. But when you compress the ball with the weight of the baseball, then that's what shoots the ball back up. It's not the initial energy of it going down.
What about the compression of the bat?
Well, I think Jim's got a point. The ball compresses, the bat has it. But I would argue that if in some way that ball stopped when it hit the bat, once the velocity goes to zero, the kinetic energy is zero.
But all that energy has gone into potential energy of the ball.
Compressing
the bat and deforming the ball.
And that's enough to increase the speed of the ball significantly?
Well, if it was ideal, it would the ball velocity coming, throw the ball against a brick wall. If there's no losses, then the speed of the ball coming back at you will be the same as the speed of the ball going to the wall.
All right, let me tell you what. Zach, the engineer, just nodded off, which means it's my cue. We got to take a break. 800-348-2551. Wake up, Zachy. We got a show to do. 800-348-2551. Science Forum. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Well, they're arguing about baseball bats. It's quite something here on the Science Forum. They really are going at it. The number is 800-348-2551. Okay. Let's just, Edward wrote in, baseballs are elastic. That's what they have rubber centers. That's what we're talking about.
Right?
Okay. I motion that we just leave the whole baseball thing alone for a little while.
Well, let's see if the listeners do that, too.
Thanks to Nick for writing that in. I'll get you back. Austin and Hudson. Austin, you're on.
Good afternoon, y'all. Thanks. So I'm just curious, in each of your respective fields, or others, if you prefer that, if you could press a button and magically disabuse the entire world of one incorrectly generally learned whatever, what would you unlearn in your field to everyone at once?
Well, rather than something specific, I think what I would do is disabuse people of the notion that science is a list of facts. And science, in fact, is a process by which we come to understand the world around us. Mm. And it's not just a bunch of immutable facts, because in fact the facts that we believe change all the time as we get better information.
Then they're not facts if it's belief,
well,
right?
It's not belief.
You said the facts that we believe.
Well, the facts that we embrace. Consider to be true.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay.
Are always tentative.
Yeah.
So, I would encourage people to embrace the scientific process more than just the factual basis.
Anybody else want to chime in here?
I have a pet peeve, if that's kind of what he's asking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. any of my students would know this one. There's the model of the atom that's often taught in elementary through high school, sometimes even in college. I've seen it in chemistry books, and I throw that one on the floor and go, patooey with you. But it is the Bohr model of the atom, which says that there's a nucleus in the center, and then there are these little delicate orbits where electrons precess, which means turn on their tippy toes in a circle in a certain direction, and there's two in one and six in another and 18 in another. And that is not at all what the atoms look like. And we've known that for over 100 years, but we still propagate this incorrect fact because it's simple.
But
like
Austin,
the plum pudding model?
Yeah.
All right, Austin, hang on just a sec. I'll let you follow up. But, I mean, it's really vibrations, right? It's levels of energy, basically.
Levels of energy, yes, right. But not levels of real estate, as I call it.
But how would you make that into a physical model that someone could understand?
It's like a puffy cotton ball of probability.
Oh, yeah, that
sure.
model.
Sure, right. Okay. So it's not as cute, but don't ever buy me a T-shirt with a Bohr model on it because it's going in the bottom drawer.
Aren't you glad you asked, Austin? What else you got?
Very much glad already, yeah. there are two others, right? Are there two more?
Oh, there are two other. There's several people in
well,
here.
Well, I'll throw the flat Earth out there because that deserves special notion.
Yeah.
Because my students still believe it.
And, oh, cut it out.
Oh, they do.
In
they
this
do.
Day and age?
Well, half of them are members of the Flat Earth Society. That's what you get.
No, Austin, he's jiving you. I mean, he's a geologist. Anybody who takes geology is going to know that, right?
I just read an article about millennials being flat Earth. There's a high percentage of them that are flat Earth believers.
All right, that's it. All right, Austin, thank you.
I think it's just cool to be a flat earther, and it shouldn't be cool.
I think I'm having a fever dream today. This is very odd. Let's go to Susan in Millbrook. Susan, you're on.
Hi, this is probably a question for Isaac Asimov or something.
Okay.
I don't know, but could the with the water rise and could it affect the poles? Could the Earth possibly change, like where the equator is the north and south, and the north and south poles become? Could it just twist?
Because of what? I'm sorry, I missed the first part.
Because of the way the weight of the water shifting in the world, that with oceans rise in water, if it could change the place of the Earth in the world. I mean, I don't have a lot of science, but I...
It does happen. For example, when the... earthquake occurred in the Indian Ocean a number of years ago and wound up killing something like 23,000 people. The Earth, the Earth's axis actually changed by about a quarter of a degree.
Wow, that's a lot.
And it was measured. Yeah, it was a lot. It went back.
And it stayed that way.
No, it rotated back afterwards. But because of the sloshing of the water in the Indian Ocean, the axis of the Earth actually changed for a period of time.
Yeah. And I think, yes, with the redistribution of the mass from ice caps melting, that does change the position of the poles.
All right.
Not by a lot, just by a little bit.
Yeah, they change more by the magnetic movement of the North Pole, South Pole.
That has changed over history, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And it continues. It's constantly changing.
Correct.
But that's a different geographic pole.
It's not a geographic pole, no.
So, okay. So Santa's moving to the equator.
Ah, there you go. Now, thanks, Susan, for the call. Now, if a city killer asteroid hit, would that be enough to do some damage to the rotation and or orbit of the Earth?
Sure. Some people even suggest that the reason that Uranus is on its side is because it got hit by something at one point or another.
And if I'm not mistaken, a bit large portion of the crust of Mars is missing on one side because it allegedly was hit by a meteor.
Yes, but that was asteroid. It was more than likely because there's some sort of meteorite or asteroid inside the structure of Mars that's done some damage to
it.
I know we talked about this gravitational anomaly in the Indian Ocean. There's, and I think we brought this up in maybe the astronomy show or maybe on this show, that there is part of the moon that has more gravitation that they suspect was part of the initial collision that formed the moon, and part of that is in the Earth, right?
Oh yeah, the thought is that a planet the size of Mars smacked into the Earth early on, and the splash from that created the moon.
And a lot of it wound up in the center of the Earth to form a larger core than there would have been otherwise.
Yeah. Ah.
And the moon is famously gravitationally lumpy. The gravity of the moon is not uniform.
I thought that was because it was a spaceship. Now, are we sure about this?
It may be hollow, and they have more stuff on one side.
Right.
But it is gravitationally lumpy, and I think it's really hard to put something into a permanent orbit around the moon.
Yeah, it bounces up and down.
Interesting. The number here is 800-348-2551. Let's see. James writes in to voxpop@wamc.org. Every kid in elementary school learns that hot air rises. During the summer, the attic is always the hottest room in the house. Since that is the case, can you please explain, in language easy enough for a kid to understand, why is it that the highest part of a mountain is actually the coldest? So cold, in fact, that the highest mountaintops are even covered in snow. How is this possible, given that hot air rises? That's from James.
Well, the temperature of the air depends a lot on the pressure that the air is under, because the atoms of the air effectively are rubbing against each other and they're making heat. As you rise up into the atmosphere, the pressure on it decreases simply because there's less air above you. And as a result, the particles move further and further apart. Mm. It gets colder.
One degree C per 1,000 feet.
Oh, really?
Generally. And it's called adiabatic expansion. And it's the reason why it's colder on top of the mountain.
You want to know something about higher elevations? Baseballs travel further.
Yes, they do.
You know that? Up in Colorado, should we go back to baseballs? Because the baseballs go, I think, about 20% further up there.
It's hard to get a pitcher who wants to pitch for Colorado because their stats are going to be all skewed.
I could talk about baseball.
Me too, Ray Graff.
Why are we doing a science forum?
Popes and baseball today on Science Forum.
Got to be the most boring sport.
What? What?
Oh,
Roger, you
game.
Had such potential, my friend. Let's go to Susan in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on.
Hello?
Hello. You're on.
Hi. My question is an earthly question as well. I'm wondering, when it's been a really dreary, cloudy day all day, and then at the end of the day we sometimes get these glorious sunsets. Is there a reason why it's been gray and cloudy all day and then the sun comes out at the very end of the day?
Can I take a stab at that?
Sure, go for it, Roger.
I would say that because the Earth starts, the surface mass where you're observing the sunset starts to cool, so the clouds start to clear, and therefore you get better visibility of the sunset.
That's not bad. I know during an eclipse, for example, there are less, all of a sudden it's cloudy all day long during an eclipse. Right before the eclipse, when it starts to getting colder, the clouds all disappear.
Huh.
And it's the same sort of thing.
This isn't like confirmation bias of any kind? I mean, we've looked at lots of data on this.
There's another part of it as well, and that's that the sun is a lot closer to the horizon during a sunset. And so the clouds are above you,
yeah.
And the sun is passing underneath it.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's what makes the beautiful sunsets, is when the clouds are above the sun, because then you get the reflection on the bottom of those clouds.
What's interesting when you watch sunsets, though, especially in Florida,
they're
red, obviously, because of the red wavelength being longer. But right before it sets, you get a green pop.
Right. You've seen that?
Yes.
I've heard people talk about it, but Susan, you want to follow up before we go off on a tangent?
No, I'm good. I was just curious about it. So basically they're saying it's the cooling at the end of the day and that the sun is closer to the horizon?
Anybody disagree?
Right. Closer to the horizon so that the clouds are above them.
Right.
Okay. Susan, thanks a lot for the call. Give me more about this green flash. I have heard about this. I have never seen it, never even an inkling of this. And, we go to the beach and we spend summer nights there and
I have to noodle the wavelengths in my head as to why. Maybe somebody knows.
It's a mirage, first of all.
It's a mirage?
It happens, though.
What happens is the sun is actually below the horizon at that point, and the light reflecting off the hot part of the atmosphere winds up coming at you, much like a piece of fiber optics almost. So
refracted.
The light is refracted into red, green, and blue, and the green happens to be the color that comes out when it hits at that wavelength.
Well, speaking,
I've never seen
ahead.
The green flash. I've been looking for the green flash.
It's a flash.
Oh, I've seen it many times.
Oh, gosh. I spent a lot of time at the beach, but only around my school schedule. So.
You've seen what I'm about to talk about, though, I'm sure. Is it a Fata Morgana? It's a mirage where things on the other side of the horizon appear.
Yes.
And it's crazy. You'll see a boat out there. Out in Maine, where we go, there's a lighthouse about 6 or 7 miles out. And some mornings, it looks enormous. It's crazy. I've seen
Myrtle Beach from 30 miles away, even though I know it's over the horizon.
Isn't that nuts?
It is weird.
Yeah, especially if you're up north, it's even better. Because there you can see mountain ranges and all sorts of things coming out from that mirage that are way, way, way away from you, but you can still see them. It's one of the reasons that Perry thought that there was actually a land off of the North Pole, because he saw what appeared to be mountains, but they were probably in Russia.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's crazy far.
Yeah.
Much further than Myrtle Beach.
Oh, yeah.
The number here is 800-348-2551. Yeah, we've been all over the map today. That's a usual science forum for you. We have Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, and Barbara Brabitz all here to answer your questions. Let's go to Dave in Lennox. Dave in Lennox, you're on. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've been interested in mineralogy lately, and feldspar is one of the minerals. It's, I guess, fairly popular. And I wonder if there's any of that in Berkshires or Adirondacks or that area.
Well, feldspar is one of the three main elements of granite. And any place you have igneous rocks, you're going to find feldspar. Some of the biggest feldspars I ever saw were in northern New York in the pegmatite mines. Because what happens there is that this is the last liquid that comes off of a granite, and it usually has very, very little in terms of mineralogy. And as a result, when it cools off, it makes huge crystals. So I have a couple of feldspar crystals at home that are maybe 10, 12 inches in diameter.
Hmm.
Dave. Wow. Yeah, are there, could you talk a little bit, too? I've learned about the feldspar crankshaft and the silicon oxide.
Feldspar crankshaft. That was a prog rock band way back when, wasn't it? I don't know. You have any idea what he's talking about, Ed?
No, I don't. I'm sorry.
All right, Dave. I'm sorry about that, my friend. 800-348-2551. Let's grab one more call, and you can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. We'll take one more call, and then we'll take a break. We'll go back to the phones, etc. Marcel is in Troy. Hello.
Hey, I got a question about pesticides. And last week I picked up a couple of piglets.
Okay.
And they're already getting ticks on them. And I picked a few off, but they're just going to keep picking up these ticks. And I wanted to know, is there a effective but environmentally benign insecticide that I could use to treat these ticks so they don't have to get pestered by these ticks?
Barbara.
Yeah, ticks are a problem because they have this really hard exoskeleton, so it takes a larger dose of pesticide to kill them. That's why in like household animals like dogs and cats, some of the anti-tick medications of the 80s and 90s no longer work on tick populations because they've evolved.
I presume you're keeping the pigs in some sort of an outside shed or barn or something along those lines?
Yep.
Put a couple of guinea hens in there.
They're out.
Put a couple of guinea hens in there.
What'd you say, Marcel?
He doesn't want guinea hens.
I didn't want guinea hens.
How about chickens? Chickens will eat your ticks too, so... And then,
I have chickens,
okay,
but I don't want anything to eat my chickens.
What about a possum?
How about thiamin?
I don't know. A tamed possum.
Thiamin? Ed says thiamin. Why thiamin, Ed?
Well, if I go off in the woods before I go off, I'll take an overdose effectively of thiamin. And what happens is it comes out of your skin And mosquitoes, ticks, things like that do not like it, so they stay away. I don't think pigs sweat, but anything that does sweat,
no,
that
they don't.
Works quite well.
Interesting. But could thiamine hurt you or a pig?
I don't think
well,
so.
Well, you excrete it. Even if you take a larger dose of thiamine, you're going to excrete it over the course of a day. For some people, it gives them a tremendous headache if they have too much thiamine. And other people mega dose it for other reasons. So I'm going to take that for homework and talk to my veterinary friends, and I'll come back next time in June with an answer for how to keep ticks off your pigs. I think the best thing you can do is really grass control. As much as we don't think ticks don't really jump. We think that they jump. They really come off. They're heat seekers, but they kind of fall off.
Right. They hang kind of like on the leaves.
Yeah, they're kind of like drunken sailors. They just kind of like fall.
Mm.
So if you can keep them away, if you're trying to have your pigs forage in like taller grass, then mowing the grass is going to do a lot to keeping the tick population down.
All right, Marcel, we're going to take a break here, but we'll pick this one up again in June. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboni, Barbara Bravitz, and Ed Stander here to answer your questions. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. Now a little lovely Nelson Riddle. Vox Pop on WAMC. Nelson Riddle, theme from Route 66 here. It's Ray Graff with the science team, Barbara Bravitz, Roger Jaboni, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here to answer your questions. Email is voxpop@wamc, and the number is 800-348-2551. Carol writes in, I'm currently working next to an active construction site in Manchester, Vermont. They've excavated down about 4 feet. Out of curiosity, can you date soil layers like you would use tree rings to date the age of a tree? How many years of soil accumulation is the equivalent of 4 feet below grass? I love this question.
Oh, my gosh, and you're all looking at me. I'm still writing down about pesticides for
pigs. All right. Let's hand it over to the geologist. What do you think, Ed?
Well, they have tried to determine the amount of time it takes for soil to be produced, and they have not done very well.
What do you mean?
Well, they tried, for example, for sediments to look at the amount of cosmic dust in the sediments, saying that the cosmic dust comes down at a particular rate, and therefore you can measure how old the sediment is or how long it's been there by the amount of cosmic dust. The problem is that soil is a byproduct. Everything is effectively being removed from it so that you're left with a material that's effectively has nothing left that can be dated. So it becomes very, very difficult to do.
Yeah, it's very biologically active, so it cycles very quickly. The nutrients in them almost always get absorbed within a season, at least into little critters that you or I don't necessarily play well with.
And I would think, unlike rock, it's fairly fungible, so it moves.
Right.
You know,
And how much deposition a tree puts down is really based upon their season. So my husband and I just put in some trees I think we found out it was 2 years ago, and they've barely grown because we've had two really tough growing seasons. Two summers ago, it was very, very wet, and then last summer, it was wet, then very dry. So these poor trees have tried really hard to take off, but they just haven't done very well. So imagine that on a larger scale or a longer scale, trying to determine like how much of that soil is from that oak tree. It's really difficult.
Yeah,
and it depends on what's growing on the soil. Like, for example, well-fertilized lawn rises at an alarming rate, engulfing your sidewalks and stuff, whereas a piece of soil out where not much grows actually probably diminishes over time.
But isn't there a constant or an accepted rate of star stuff that comes down every year?
Yeah, but the problem is that you've got a soil that's there. The soil grows downward. It doesn't grow necessarily upwards.
What do you mean?
Well, rock breaks down, and as it breaks down, it produces soil. So you can have, for example, a bedrock and then soil on top of it. Over time, that bedrock's going to break down as well and produce more soil. So it doesn't just grow upwards, it also grows downwards.
Speaking of rocks, and then we'll go back to the phones, 800-348-2551. I was going up and down the Taconic Parkway a few weeks ago. And for once, I was a passenger, and I was looking along the side. Saw these, I've seen this before, but this was very vivid. A tree growing right out of a rock. There was no soil. How do you do that?
Was it a birch?
You know what? I didn't have time.
You're going to have to go back and
really
check
and find out why.
The reason birch can do that is because birch seeds have little wings on them, and the wings get stuck in the rock so that they can grow pretty well anywhere. And once they grow, then they can start effectively breaking the rock apart as it grows.
It's got to be a long process.
Oh, it can be. But the first of all, once you start breaking a rock, then if water gets in there, the water then breaks it even faster because as it freezes, it cracks it.
What?
And any crack in the rock, there's going to be some soil in there just by wind-blown
and water,
stuff.
Because water's going to take the path of least resistance, which is going to be where the crack is.
You want to talk about pigs and ticks again? Because Kathy in Shaftesbury, Vermont does. She says, I just caught the tail end of the tail of the ticks on the pigs. For several years now, I've put making my own tick tubes that I have been making my own tick tubes that I put around the yard under leaves, in with firewood, anywhere a mouse might look for nesting materials. I've not had ticks in my yard since then. I do it every year in April. I won't go into how to make them and how they work. You can Google that. But basically, I save toilet paper tubes and dryer lint to make them with. You can buy them, too, but they're very expensive. What I make costs almost nothing. What's it? You ever use a tick tube?
Never used a tick tube, but it's probably using the same idea of other attractants that are not pesticide, right? You can even buy little strips that are adhesive. So if a tick walks across it, it's going to get stuck and then, you know, just die of dehydration by being stuck there.
Yeah, there's something else I just remembered as well. One thing I've noticed, and I'd love to be able to see proof of it, is that lawns that have thyme growing on them almost never have ticks.
Thyme.
Thyme, T-H-Y-M-E,
wild
thyme.
Huh.
And apparently the ticks don't like to have a wild thyme, so it works extremely well.
So were you just waiting for that opportunity?
I have been waiting for weeks.
You're like the Shecky Green of the science world, you know?
It's dad joke 101.
Apparently the tick tubes work.
Do they?
Apparently, okay. Because you stuff them with nesting material for mice, and then it interrupts the tick cycle on mice.
Splendid. Well, that's interesting. John is in Poughkeepsie. John, go ahead.
Hi. The question is about ultraviolet light that can cause sunburns coming from the sun. I read where if you're, say, sitting under a shady tree on a summer's day and you're in shade, but off in the distance is a large white cloud that's bouncing sunlight back on you, that is bouncing ultraviolet light that can give you a sunburn. Does your guest agree with that or think that's plausible?
Yeah. Yes.
Yep.
That's certainly the case. The under right conditions, clouds can amplify the amount of sunlight by quite a bit. And the ultraviolet, especially the shortest wavelengths that can cause sunburn, it's heavily scattered. So it comes from all over the sky.
Hmm.
So if you're sitting under a small patch of shade, so you're out of the direct sun, but you can see still most of the sky, you're getting almost the same amount of UV as you would
there you go.
Out in the sun.
Well, I just think of the polar explorers having snow blindness, which is really a sunburn of your retina, because they're getting the UV light that's reflected off of the snow and the ice that they're traveling on. And so even what we would consider sunglasses was not enough. They had to put those little slits in pieces of wood in front of their eyes so they could just see straight ahead, and everything reflected from down below towards their eyes would be reflected back off the,
amazing.
Off the pieces of wood.
John, thanks a lot. Now, let's get back to baseball for a minute. Baseball players often put the charcoal under their eyes. Why?
That's cool.
Is that it? I mean, does it have anything to do with
it
vision?
Works. It does work because your skin is, well, not everybody's skin is as white as mine, but you have that white skin and that too is going to scatter And that is going to give you a little bit of a glare. And you need to be able to see a white ball in a blue or white sky without any extra glare that's coming around that. So it kind of cleans up the glare. You know, the sunglasses do the same, but it's not nearly as cool.
So when you get snow blindness, it goes away.
Well, you can actually affect your vision permanently.
So it's not exactly the same as looking at the sun.
Oh, you mean like at an eclipse or something?
If
like
I
that?
Were to look at the sun, theoretically, if I did it long enough, I would go blind.
Right.
This is not the same.
No, but it's a really bad it's a bad sunburn and a terrible place to get a sunburn. Your retina really doesn't want to get a sunburn, right? It's pretty important to have those retinas work.
Yeah,
so.
But it looks marvelous. Mary writes in, besides time dilation and the current limited fuel that would gain enough speed, is there any other reason we couldn't one day break the speed of light to allow time travel? We broke the speed of sound, which was thought theoretically impossible. Couldn't we theoretically one day pass the speed of light, allowing for time travel? And that's from Mary in Wilbraham.
Not by any means currently known to science.
That's a very good qualified answer.
Yeah, the laws of Einstein is very rarely shown to be wrong about things, and the speed of light being the speed limit is about as firmly established as anything. It would take a total revolution in understanding of
space-time. Right, because right now, space-time, we can only go in one direction in space-time.
Right.
We can't go backwards.
We can't fold space-time?
Well.
Yeah.
That
you
never got a chance to voice my pet peeve, but it was the speed of light being the limit.
Go ahead.
That is a pet peeve of mine. And before we came in, we were just discussing the book Imminent by
Luis Elizondo.
Yeah.
And he talks about the ability for UAPs to warp space-time around their spacecraft.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm going there.
Yeah, and I don't believe a word of it. So
I'm not sure I believe it or not. I need to understand it a little better.
Wouldn't it require vast amounts of power?
Vast.
All right. Well, shall we just stand here for a few more minutes, or shall we take some calls? What do you think, Ed?
Take a call.
All right, let's do that then. We'll go to Ellington, Connecticut. Randall, you're on.
Yeah, hello.
Hi.
I had a question statement relating to evolution versus creation.
Okay.
Since it's physically impossible for evolution to prove by any means whatsoever that two different sexes occurred spontaneously and fully developed by evolution, and we have over 1.5 million species of plants, vegetables, brush, trees, insects, and fish, birds. They had to be created simultaneously to effectively reproduce. Throws the theory of evolution completely out the door because it's physically impossible for evolution to explain that.
Okay, so Barbara, you first.
Oh, great. Terrific. In bacteria can elect to be a positive or a negative, which would be kind of like a bacterial equivalent of male and female. Any one bacterium, given how crowded it is, what their species is, some can do this and some can't, can change their situation in order to sexually reproduce. Most bacteria do not. As a general rule, they don't undergo sexual reproduction. They go through asexual reproduction. But if their situation is dire, they go through this phase where some can become positives and some become negatives in order to exchange genetic material and effectively go through sexual reproduction. So that, to me, is proof that there is something pre-gender, male and female, out there in the evolutionary record.
Anybody else? All right. Hearing nothing. 800-348-2551. Steven says, hey, just a correction. Snow blindness affects the cornea and not the retina.
Thanks.
Is that true?
I will have to go check my resources.
That's two homeworks for you.
I would say that probably is true because it's UV that's doing it, and UV is what causes the cornea to go white.
Oh.
Yes, but the cornea is tissue. It's not cells.
True.
And it's usually cells that get sunburned.
So I suspect Roger's looking this up right now. Is that true, Roger?
Is he iPhoning it in the corner?
Yeah, you know what? There's a strict no device rule here in the studio.
That's right. That's what makes the show so fun.
Chris in Catskill. Chris, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
You betcha.
My question is about the Big Bang.
Yeah.
And the common belief now is that the universe is speeding up rather than slowing down. And my question is always, or my thought has always been that, you know, in an explosion, at the very beginning of an explosion, things are speeding up until they start to slow down. And is it possible that on a cosmic scale, 14 billion years is still just the beginning of the explosion, and that eventually things will continue to slow down and then, you know, come back on themselves for a big crunch?
Ed, what do you think?
Yes, except that what we know of the universe right now is that it was speeding up at the beginning, then it slowed down, and now it's speeding up again. So effectively you're going, it's like saying a fireworks display where the pieces are coming off the fireworks are going a certain speed, then they slow down, and then all of a sudden they start speeding up again, and there's no reason for that. So physicists usually consider the speeding up of the universe being due to something they call dark energy, which is, I'm using my fingers as air parentheses here. But there are other possibilities, too. One possibility, for example, is that the speed of light actually varied over time. It wasn't always the same. And therefore, the speeding up or slowing down may just be due to the fact that the universe was actually contracting or expanding at a different rate. So there are other possibilities. But
these are all just possibilities.
Everything until we get out there is a possibility.
Yeah. Chris, thanks a lot for that one.
What's difficult and causes your brain to melt is that the Big Bang was not like an explosion.
No.
It's tempting, and that's the way it's portrayed in images, but it wasn't like that.
What do you mean? And how do you know?
Because it's something that occurred literally everywhere at once.
Right. Well, yeah.
So it's not like one point. It's not expanding into anything.
Boy, we hit everything today, didn't we? All of these groan points.
Well, it's a melt your brain kind of.
Oh, look
problem.
At the time. We're all done here. Barbara Brabitz, Roger Jaboni, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander, thank you all for being here. Well done, my friends. We'll do a science forum again tomorrow. Support comes from Albany Marriott, Wolf Road, Albany, New York. Full-service hotel with flexible meeting space and features such as a restaurant, cocktail lounge, mobile check-in at Mobile Key, albanymarriott.com. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the forests, wetlands, shorelines, and ridges that protect Lake George permanently. Projects, events, and news at lglc.org. Once again, thanks to the Science Gang for being here. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Zachary T. Malloy, the captain of the Enterprise that is the control room. Susie Chekai was our screener today. Thanks, Susie. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's Food Friday. We'll take a dive into the pantry with Jennifer Clare. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. Hey, listen, your station, your stories continues. These voices show why AMC is here, why we will not be going anywhere. There's a lot of stuff going on. And in a minute, after Count Basie wraps it up with a huge finish, we're going to hear from another one of our listeners and hear their story. Share your story with us. Also, share your money with us. 800-323-9262. These are tough times. We need you.